Hi, my name is Martin Purnell and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go to church or don't go to church and those who feel disconnected from church. On today's podcast is Rob Halligan, who I've had the pleasure to interview a couple of times at the start of this century. Rob is a singer-songwriter with a dedicated following and glowing reviews in the mainstream media. He has spoken publicly about his father dying in the 9/11 terrorist attacks, and you might have seen him recently on Songs of Praise doing just that. But what has he been up to since we last talked? And what was it like to be involved in starting a new church? How did his own feelings and thoughts about coming out of a very controversial and troubled church help or hinder him? How has he coped with post-lockdown? And have the past years actually helped him with his songwriting and gigging? We'll find out as we speak now to Rob Halligan. Rob, hi. Thanks for joining us. Long time no speak, good sir.
Yeah, hello. It was the beginning of the century, wasn't it? That was a long time ago.
It was indeed. Well, as you know, I'm in Northern Ireland now. Where are you, good sir?
I'm in Coventry.
I've heard of Coventry. I've been there for yonks. More about that later on, no doubt. And we'll see if we can get any specials references in there as well and two-tone. See what happens. See what happens. But before we go anywhere else, if you would like to write to us and tell us what you think, whatever, my email address is OGC, which is Off Grid Christianity. That's OGC at accessradio.biz. And biz is spelled B-I-Z. But before we go any further, let's do those five questions for you, Rob. Fingers on the buzzers, no conferring, if that's all right. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
Now, that's an interesting one, because a lot of, well, when I think of that kind of thing, I think I immediately go to my heroes.
Yeah.
And think, you know, who are my heroes in life and that kind of stuff. But then I kind of think, actually, there is this, you know, the old adage, never meet your heroes.
Yes.
And so I don't think I'd like to burst the bubble by doing that. I think I'm very good at beating myself up. And, you know, as I've grown older, I've realized that there's a lot of my parents in me. And I've realized that because I see myself in my kids, and you sort of, you start realizing all this stuff. And my grandfather on my mum's side, my mum never met him. He disappeared sort of during the war, and it was all like that. So I'd like to meet him just to find out what he was like. And yeah, I don't know. I'd just be fascinated.
Wow, that's a great answer. There's a series on Channel 4 at the moment called My Grandfather's War.
Yeah.
Where they're taking well-known people and they trace that. That'd be a great program to do for you. We'll see if I can arrange it. That's a great answer. Thank you. Question two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please?
Well, I don't know. It changes. I think like a lot of people, you like to identify with people like, I don't know, David, King David, mm-hmm. Kind of was a man after God's own heart, but messed up and did things wrong as well. And you think, yeah, that's me, because I, you know, I mess up all the time, but I'm a man after God. Or Simon Peter, you know, who I like to think of the New Testament version of David.
Yeah, but, good point.
You know, but actually one of my favorite, again, you're going to learn about, you know, my kind of insecurities or lack of faith through this, because I think one of, and I've talked about this in my gigs a little bit, one of my favourite bits or little stories that you pick up in the Bible is the guy who says to Jesus, Lord, I believe, help me in my unbelief. Uh-huh. Because it was a bit, you know, it's a little bit like he gave me the license to say to Jesus, Lord, you know, God, I do believe in you, but I don't. And I'm having a real problem at the moment, and I need your help to sort of believe in you. And he gave me the license to say, look, I do have doubts, rather than trying to sort of be this confident, everything's okay, because sometimes everything isn't okay. So I like, you know, that's probably one of the, it's a strange sort of thing to say, I know, but it's one of the stories that has made me think, actually, you know, I'm really glad he was there.
That's a great answer. Well, great answers all along so far. Let's see what happens for the next one, Rob. Question three. If you were Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, what would it be?
I think the law would be that you could only be Prime Minister if you didn't want to be Prime Minister.
Oh, explain.
Because I think politicians in general are just driven by ambition. I very seldom do I believe that they have totally the best interests of the country at heart. I think there is a bit of that. There has to be, I suppose, when they start out. But a lot of it is ambition. A lot of it, I think, is I don't know. I think it takes a very special kind of person to be put in a leadership sort of position, like the Prime Minister, or like a politician of any sort, I suppose, and that is totally selfless. That is has got really the best intentions of the people and the populace at heart. My law would be, something like that, something like a very time restricted and you can't be the Prime Minister if you really want to be.
So do I take it then you don't want to be Prime Minister?
Oh, I really want to.
Blast.
Oh, I can't be here.
Blast. You had me there. I just when I thought I reeled you in and made you Prime Minister. Very good. Question four. Well, you're too intelligent, so yes, you're definitely going to be Prime Minister, I've decided. Yeah, sorry about that, Rob. Question four. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out?
Oh, dear. This was quite a hard one when I thought about this because I think one of my best days out or times away with somebody was with my mate Mike Rimmer. And we, in 2004, I'd recorded an album and there was a song off the album called Streets of This Town, and I had the opportunity to go to America to film a video. Mm-hmm. And we filmed it in New York, and Mike came with me.
Oh,
and
wow.
We spent a few days together just traipsing around the streets of New York, dancing with the Naked Cowboy, recording some songs together. You had to be there. But absolutely one of the most memorable and fun times.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned his name because I was hoping it was going to come up. Mike, as you know, used to be a colleague of mine in my Cross Rhythms days, and before that UCB as well. And unfortunately, Mike sadly departed last week. So I think this will be a very apt time, really, just for you to share a quick obituary on what Mike meant to you as a mate.
I met Mike at the Cross Rhythms Roots and Branches Festival. In Dudley.
Dudley.
Goodness, that would be 96.
Yeah, I was there.
Mike had written this article that I'd read called You Are What You Hear. And I was blown away by this article. It was in one of the sort of free magazines you got with one of these Christian music clubs. And I guess I almost prayed that I would meet Mike because I thought this article. And whoever was on stage sort of emceeing that night, between the bands, was talking to the audience and made some sort of comment like, oh, that's a nice raincoat, or that's a nice trench coat, Mike Rimmer. And I thought, wow, that's Mike Rimmer. So I made a beeline for him and we got talking. He invited us for dinner and I was in a sort of church band. He's the one who said, I should go solo. I've got stories to tell. I'd be a good storyteller, and I was really unsure. We had this conversation where he was talking like that, and I said, I don't know. And he said, well, it's too late because I've booked the Mac in Birmingham and we've got somebody singing and you're opening for her. So he kind of press ganged me into my first gig.
Wow.
And I wouldn't be doing any of this
stuff
that I do without, if it wasn't for Mike. But I am just one of hundreds of people, it's amazing to look on his, on the Facebook page, Pray for Mike Rimmer Facebook group, because there are just story after story of people that are saying, you know, Mike did this, Mike was this to me, that Mike, if it hadn't been for him, you know, he supported me in this music or whatever it was. Very passionate guy in terms of his faith. I remember hearing this recording he did. He had a cold call from one of these salespeople, and he brought this person to the Lord.
Wow.
On the phone. It was brilliant.
Wow.
You know, and they didn't sell him anything.
Wow. Wow.
So, yeah, quite an amazing guy, really.
Wow. Yeah, I always remember Mike for being the first person. Do you remember when the internet first really took off in like the mid-1990s? Late 1990s, and BT actually brought out a phone which was about the size of a phone book, but as well as the digits on there, you also had the alphabet, so you could actually text an email on this little screen thing. And Mike had heard of that and sent it to an address that I had, and it was so long, that address, and he just wanted to be the first person to say, welcome to the real world. I know what it's like when nobody actually contacts you, which is, that's what I always remember Mike for being the first person to ever email me on my private address. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Question 5. What has been your most embarrassing moment?
I don't know. I've had a lot. Some of them have been horribly embarrassing that I sort of really not want to revisit. Yeah, I don't know. Oh, goodness me. I struggled with this, you know. And I'm still struggling, as you can see. Because there's, you know, as a musician, there is always times on stage where you either forget words.
Yes.
I fell off the stage once.
Oh, well done.
That was at an After the Fire gig. Yeah, being rather animated and fell off the stage. So those things are always quite, you know, I don't know, quite embarrassing. I don't know. Sorry. that's really boring, isn't it?
I thought you were going to mention the fact you turned up to a radio station a week before your actual interview.
I'm rubbish at interviews, really, because I either forget they're happening or... that was one of the first times I met you, I think.
Yeah.
I just put the wrong Thursday in my diary.
And you turned up, and I was, apparently, you remember the story, I don't at all, but apparently I was very polite, so that was good news. Or was I? Maybe you were just being too polite.
Yeah, you professionally winged it.
That's a good answer, I like that. I like that. Our optician, the receptionist there, she's known as a professionally rude person. It was so funny the way it happened. And so she dines out on that. I think that's a great line. You're a professionally rude person, she was told.
Actually, I tell you what, I do have a rather amusing sort of... So before I sort of became a musician, I had a number of jobs, and one of them was in a health food shop.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was probably about 16, 17. I'd literally just come off the streets, and I was a bit rough and ready. And a lady came in, and she leant over the counter. We had all these herbal remedies for different things, you see.
Yeah.
She leant over the counter and said, "Excuse me, do you have anything for flatulence?" Now, I didn't have a clue what that meant.
Oh.
So I shouted across the shop to the manager. This lady needs something for flatulence. And this lady walked out.
Well, there's a surprise.
Then I don't know who was more embarrassed, when I found out or the lady. Anyway, there you go.
There you go. Well, that's good. Thank you very much indeed. Well, Rob, now let's get to the mainstream. We've got a better understanding of you. If that's all right. A little birdie, by the way, I'm going to throw this as an opener, right? A little birdie says, when you speak to Rob Halligan, ask him about his meeting with the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, either he's got something...
Oh, goodness me.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me more.
So, okay, there are a number of threads to this meeting. Back in 1991... I went to the Glastonbury Festival.
Yes.
And our church went with, we were part of a group of other churches that went, led by a guy called Vic Jacobson, the Hope Now. And we all had these rainbow t-shirts and had a Christian field and all of this kind of thing. And the Bishop of Bath and Wells turned up.
Oh, right.
And so, because everybody was trying to sort of look after him and everything, and they wanted to give him a tour of the site. Now, I had like a minibus or an old clapped out old van that I was driving around and moving things around the site with. So I got the job of taking the Bishop of Bath and Wells around, and it was George Carey.
Yes.
And so I took him, you know, I drove and I didn't really speak to him much, but I didn't have a pass. It was quite embarrassing. I didn't have a pass. We blagged it in to the site back then and I didn't have a pass and we were stopped by security and I got asked to leave. So it's all quite embarrassing, really. So there you go, another embarrassing moment. Anyway, fast forward to 2001, and you mentioned in the introduction about my dad, yes. I losing my dad in 9/11. There was a big 9/11 memorial service in November 2001 at Westminster Abbey. And I was, our family went to it. It was all the families, the British families that were there. And the Archbishop of Canterbury was preaching. And after it, we all got shuttled off to St. James Palace or somewhere like that for like a supper, a sort of buffet thing.
Yeah.
Now, my family had struggled with me becoming a Christian. There's a lot they didn't really get. And I was sort of, it was difficult when I first
became. I know the feeling.
I was one of these, you know, and because I'd been a bit of a scallywag as well before all that. So we were there and I went up to get some food, and there next to me getting the food was the Archbishop. George Carey, and he said, he said hello. He said, "Are you one of the bereaved?" And we started talking. And I said, "Well, actually, we've met before." And he said, "Oh, when was that?" And I said, "Well, do you remember Glastonbury?" He said, "Oh, yes, I remember Glastonbury. Oh, the mud at Glastonbury." He said, "I said, well, do you remember the minibus?" He went, "Oh, that was your minibus, wasn't it?" "Yes, I did." So we got talking. And he said, "Are your family here?" So I took him over to see my family, you know, and I introduced him to everyone. And he was very friendly and everything. And he said, "It's so good to meet you all. It really is good. And it's so good to see Rob again. I mean, the work that Rob does up in Coventry with the homeless and what he does with, working for the church and doing this and that and everything, absolutely amazing. And I'm sure you support him in that." I'm, you know, really kind of milking it, really.
Yeah.
And then he sort of looked at me, he says, "Well, Rob, it's really good to see you again. You know where to you know how to contact me if you need to. Just give me a call if you need to. It's so good to see you again." And he wandered off. And my American stepmother looked at me and she goes, "Well, you never told us you knew the Archbishop of Canterbury." So, yeah. Yeah.
That is a brilliant, brilliant true story as opposed to the old story about Frank Sinatra. Do you know about that one?
What was that?
I don't know whether it's true or not. You hear people tell it from time to time. But so anyway, you can imagine you're in a nice exclusive restaurant and this bloke is trying to be really sort of romantic to his future wife, girlfriend, whatever. And he sees Frank Sinatra going to the toilet. So he goes over to Frank Sinatra and says, "Look, when you come by next time, I'm trying to be, you know, really romantic to hopefully my future wife. Could you just say, turn around and say, hello, Fred, how you doing?" Right? And Frank Sinatra says, "Yeah, all right, I'll do that." So, you know, he's having goes back to the table and is talking to his girlfriend or hopefully a future girlfriend. And with that, about 10 minutes later, Frank Sinatra walks by and stops around and says, "Hi, Fred, how's it doing?" And the bloke looks up and says, "Frank, can I see him having a private meal? Just leave me alone, please." And yours is a better story, and I wish I could have told the joke properly, but yours is a true story, and it's much better. And that's going to go down in my most embarrassing moment, I think, because it's like the tumbleweeds just go straight across the screen. Or like, yeah. Why did you tell that, Martin? I don't know, but I did. Archbishop Canterbury, though, that is interesting. So, first of all, because the little birdie who told me to ask you that has been proven correct, so that's good.
Okay.
But secondly...
I'd like to know who that was.
I'll tell you off air. I'll tell you off air. But secondly, that's a little more involved, if that's all right. Because I did say at the top of the programme that, you know, you're involved in a church that might have had, well, not might have, that it was steeped in cult stuff and court cases and everything else. Yeah. But I also mentioned that you were going to, you have started up a church as well, a church plant. So what was your mind like when you were going to do a church plant and what you'd learnt from being in this cult church?
Goodness. So, okay. So, yeah, we... Let me go right back. So we were part... I was part of the Jesus Army, the Jesus Fellowship. Now, it's an interesting thing talking about the Jesus Army for me, because it's something that I struggle with quite a lot in terms of... I mean, just trying to sort it all out in my head, what was, you know, what was good and what wasn't good. Because there were some aspects of it that were amazing. There really were. There were people there that were passionate about Jesus. There were people there that were amazing. You know, if you look at some of the stuff that happened, particularly with the Jesus centers, which were set up to work with the homeless people, it was quite amazing. For me, I was living on the streets. I was pulled off, I'd been living on the streets when I was 15. I was given somewhere to stay, given somewhere to live, and it was great. There was an idealism in terms of how, I don't know, as a community or as a sort of alternative society, how we could live or whatever, which I think with any ideology, when things are inflexible, that's where things go wrong. In hindsight, looking at it and unraveling it all, it was incredibly controlling. That was the big thing. That was the main thing. And so there were abuses just in terms of the bullying and the control, something that I was a victim of.
Can you, because we often hear this, don't we, about our abusive and bullying within the church. Mm. And I'm sure there are people who are going to be listening to this podcast who can relate to that, but maybe don't fully understand what kind of bullying does go on. So perhaps you could tell us, please, what kind of bullying you actually receive, please.
Well, I mean, I suppose it's in the form of control. Mm. You know, I mean, I liken it. I think because people say, you know, well, if you're part of something like that, why don't you just get up and go?
Yes.
Why don't you get up and leave? I think there are a number of reasons. First of all, there is a faith element. You have often made a commitment. You've made a vow that, and in the Jesus Fellowship, in Jesus Army case, it was a lifelong covenant. And you said before God, you made this covenant, you see. Mm. And so to walk away from that, you'd be breaking this vow that you made before God. So you are in this fairly rigid setup, fairly rigid organization. I fell out. I stood my ground on a lot of things, which made me fairly unpopular with Noel, who was the main leader. We moved out of the community just after we got married, me and my wife, which was back in 96, I think, 97. And we moved away from the central part of the church, which was in Northampton, we moved to Coventry in Warwickshire, which was like being in a different church. And I think it really did, in some ways, depend on what congregation you were in and who was around. I think there was just, it was a sort of thing where people were given responsibilities as leaders that shouldn't have been.
Where we've heard that one before, yes.
There was lack of accountability,
yes,
for certain leaders, all of that kind of thing.
Yes.
It just depended. I mean, there was everything sort of from financial stuff, you know, because there was it, because in your community it was a common purse community. So what you earned, you paid everything into. So you were part of a house group or a household. Right. That household had a bank account. Everybody that lived there put all their money into that one bank account.
Mm-hmm.
That paid for all the bills. It paid for all the cars that belonged to the house, all of that kind of stuff, which, like I say, ideally it worked. It was great. But obviously it's open to abuse and control. So there are things like that.
Yes. Yeah. Looking back on it now, being on the streets at 15,
yeah,
you know, to go into something like that, those are tremendous positives, surely. But if you had, yeah, your time again, would you still have joined the community?
I think so. I mean, it's easy to say all these things.
Yeah, isn't it? Just
hindsight. I think, you know, when you know what you know, then if you could go back, you'd call people out. You know.
Yeah.
You say stuff. There were obviously some more serious abuses, you know, sort of criminal abuse,
yes,
sexual, physical abuse. Those were dealt with. And I mean, I think the horrible thing is, and I did deal with some of these things on an album that I did, because, you know, there is the whole relationship. It's, you know, you're grieving for something that you, yeah, put yourself into. Or at the same time, there are people that were heroes, if you like, who turned out to be certainly not heroes, you know. And interestingly, you know, it's the more you look at it, you realize that this happens across the board. Jesus Fellowship was, I don't know, it was like the perfect storm, because it was a community, it was a commune, yeah, it was, you know. But in so many, not in secular things like the BBC or whatever big sort of corporations that you think you can trust, or in the church as a whole, there are some amazing people who have turned out to have some really dark sides to them, you know.
Absolutely.
And so I think dealing with, I wrote a song called When Heroes Fall, and it really, you know, it throws you all over the place. I likened it like, you know, you're on a storm tossed ocean. You're sort of trying to work it all out, waiting for the calm, and it's not coming, because, yeah, just trying to work out, hang on a second, but they said that and that was brilliant, and they did that and that was brilliant, but they did that and it was awful, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So, because it's very easy to put your trust in somebody and take your eyes off Jesus, and you know what the, yeah, Bible says. It's so easy. So, how does that motivate you?
So, I think that's been one of the big lessons, I think, for me, is that being somebody that was from a fairly sort of messy family, had a messy relationship with my dad and my stepdad and other people that came after that, and constantly looking for that kind of figure, if you like, and realizing, actually, I need to learn not, I suppose, I need to learn to be able to put God there and not to keep relying on, you know, people to be infallible and feel this thing that, you know, this ideal that I want them to feel. And I think that's been really quite important. It's been very, it's been quite a journey these last sort of 3 or 4 years, learning to trust God rather than men, I suppose, because, you know, we've been, I know I, sort of over recent years, I was very involved in a kind of leadership network across Coventry of leaders from different churches. And I realized when I first became involved in that, I was really looking up to some of these other guys, thinking, they're the bee's knees, you know. And various things happened. You know, you hang out with some of them and you think, oh, you're not as perfect as I thought. And that's been really helpful. And it isn't in a judgmental way. It's just realizing, actually, my rock should be Jesus, not, you know, my rock should be God. And realizing that God is the one that sustains and keeps us. It keeps us through relationships, whether those relationships are tricky relationships or not. There is, it's just learning to trust in God.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, it's been a tricky, interesting journey.
No, I hear you with my own particular journey. So, yes, I understand that entirely. But there must have been, because it's very easy in the media to look at all the bad things that have happened.
Yeah.
Of which, you know, we've only just scraped the surface of how bad it was. And obviously, there are people still affected by what's happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, our heart cries out to them because of what they've been through, because they were trusting someone. What about any good things that came out that has helped you for where you are today?
Well, you learn from your mistakes, so that's a good, you know.
If you want to learn from your mistakes, that
if
is.
You want to, yeah. But no, I think there are good things just in terms of So in terms of what we've been through, Jesus Fellowship was, it's funny, in recent years, when they started to address some of the stuff that went on, that's when we really, we really tuned into things like safeguarding and all of that kind of stuff. And on that safeguarding journey, that's been incredibly helpful. I think for us, and that covers a whole area of just looking out for people, understanding people, realizing, and going to other churches or other organizations, and you think, oh, you need to be careful there and stuff like that. So you do learn things like that. I mean, aside from all of that, there are obviously people that are damaged, but there are other people whose lives have been transformed and changed. There are testimonies of God's grace. There's testimonies of healing. People that have gone on to other churches and done some amazing stuff. There is a girl that we know who we live with in a community house. She left the community house. She's a nurse. She went to work on the Mercy ships and has worked her way up.
Wow.
As one of the trainers on the Mercy ships, done some absolutely incredible things on that, you know, and you realize that that's been part of her journey. For me, sort of standing my ground and fighting my corner, which was quite painful at times, has put me in a really good place just in terms of what I do now, in terms of my music ministry, traveling around, and I do events management and that kind of stuff. A lot of that, you know, I learned and I picked up from some of the things that we did in the church. All sorts of things. For a while I was running, for about 5 years, I was managing a drop-in center for the homeless. And so there are so many things, good things that happened, lives that you saw that were really transformed, really changed.
Yes, yes. What's your wife's name, Rob?
Jean.
Jean. So I don't know who came up, who was first person to talk in your family about, let's start a church. But surely with what happened in the past, that must have affected you as to whether to go for it or not. What do you remember that time about starting up a new church then?
Well, what actually happened was when Jesus Fellowship was breaking up and closing, before kind of on the run up for that, we were part of the local sort of Jesus Fellowship congregation in Coventry. Mm-hmm. And we'd already been doing quite a lot of our own stuff anyway. And it was just quite interesting when the senior leadership of the church all stepped down or were suspended from leadership and it all started to go pear-shaped. There was this a bit of a kind of void. I was running our drop-in center at the time, and I was one of the people that stepped in. There was four of us at the time, four of us, I think, who stepped in to basically take up the reins of these people that were kind of left wondering what to do. Bearing in mind, a lot of these people have been part of the church for 30 years. And there was obviously a bit of sorting out. Some people went off and, to find other churches, which was great. We were wondering what we would do. We've been quite involved in a place called Scargill House, mm-hmm. which is a retreat. It's a retreat centre up in the middle of Yorkshire, and it's kind of attached to Lee Abbey, which is down in Devon. Mm-hmm. And I was shortlisted for a job as chaplain there. And we were thinking, oh, well, maybe we'll go up there. We were seriously thinking about just relocating and starting something new. And that was going to be a process, a bit of a time thing to work out what we were doing. And so while we were still in Coventry, we were, we said, right, we need to start, if we're going to stay together as a congregation, this needs to be a new church. We need to start this properly. And so with the help of, there was a couple of other churches, Jubilee Church, who was from New Frontiers, and the City Church, which is part of Covenant Ministries, or came out of Covenant Ministries. They helped us in terms of putting together and planting a new church, which was an amazing experience, just seeing a group of people who were just really committed to each other. Mm. And working out how do you come out of a setup that is very controlling, that is very sort of rigid, and how do you start asking some, really serious questions? And it's an incredible group of people that have stuck it, and it's a really healthy church now. It's called Well of Life. Now,
that's in Coventry.
That's in Coventry, yeah. And they have their main ministry, actually, their main focus is working with Iranian asylum seekers.
Oh, wow.
And they do a lot of stuff with Iranians.
Wasn't that on Songs of Praise recently? Or am I thinking of another church?
No, that was a different church, okay. Yeah. But I did see that one, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, so it's, it's been really good. Now, I was due in 2020 to make a decision about Scargill and the chaplain. Mm. And then we went into lockdown. Scargill went into lockdown. But we sort of thought, actually, we've said we're moving on. We need to move on. And so we moved on from Well of Life. And just having had the time that we'd had, we just took a couple of years breathing space to think about, what do we do now? Seriously, where does it look like for us now? Mm. Which at first was really difficult, because we drilled into you, you've got to be part of a church, you've got to be, yeah. When you're not, it's like, we're doing something wrong here.
Yeah.
But actually, it's been the best time.
I'd like to pick your brains on something else then, if that's right. Within this category, going back to Skegness, 2001, we were doing live outside broadcasts every night from Spring Harvest on Crossrooms Radio.
Okay.
And we were part of the youth event, and I was underneath the stage. Mm. And the chap who was doing the youth ministry worship band, he came and joined me one night. And what I can't remember his name. Let's call him Mark. Might be Frank Sinatra for all I know. But we'll call him Mark. And in between the tracks, I said, "What church you go to?" And he said, "St. Thomas the Crooks." I said, "What, the one in Sheffield?" And then the 9 o'clock service. And he said, "Yes."
Yeah.
I said, "Well, do you mind talking about that?" And he said, "Yeah." And I thought, well, this is really good because, you know, this was still fresh in people's memories about how, like, you know, you've been alluded to.
So was this after it all?
Yes. Okay. Yes. We're talking in maybe 2-3 years after. Mm-hmm. But for those that don't know, there was this big church service in Sheffield, in Thomas the Crooks. And the vicar was a young go-ahead, you know, I can do this. And he got all the kids coming in. And what started off as a youth event on a Sunday night then morphed into this big thing that then went to the town hall in Stoke into Sheffield. Close, be City Hall then, wouldn't it? And it got so big that he was fast-tracked from curate to vicar in the space of weeks. And then he was putting down these ideas that when he was going to be ordained, he wanted to wear the very cloth shirt that Robert De Niro wore in The Mission. So the church paid all this money over because they thought he was fantastic. He was bringing all these kids in.
Yeah.
And then similar to what you were saying, Jesus Army, it just imploded big time. And Mark was very kind, explained it all. And I said, so, you know, what happened to the people there? And he said, well, about 300 people lost their faith.
Yeah, and that's the saddest thing, isn't it?
And that's what I'd like to ask you then, because you've met people who are obviously in a similar situation and who might be hopefully listening today just saying, well, so what would you say to them?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, because, I mean, it's one of the things that I find and my wife finds really sad is, you know, I was very young when I joined the church.
Yeah.
And there were people in the sort of a couple of years younger than me who'd grown up, and people of my age and older who had been kids and it had been their life. Yeah. And a lot of those people of my generation lost their faith or maybe didn't have one because they were brought up in quite a controlling environment. That's the saddest thing that, you know, and it is like any church. I mean, the Church of England is talking about it at the moment, aren't they? You know, where they're dealing with various sort of things, cases of abuse and stuff like that, where it is the place that you should have, you know, it's a church. It is the people of God, for goodness sake. It is a place where you should be feeling the most safe, the most loved and cared for, and yet it's the place that that there is abuse. I think for me, like I say, on this journey that I've been on, it is about learning to trust God. And if I can, I want to jump to with the 9/11 thing. This was my help, I suppose. After 9/11, immediately after 9/11, a lot of questions that were being fired around was, well, how can there be a God if God lets things like this happen?
And for those that don't know, your dad died in one of the Twin Towers, didn't he? Yeah.
My concise way of saying this was that I asked myself after 9/11, I had that same kind of struggle, if you like, with faith. And I had to ask myself, well, do I actually believe in God? And, you know, I can't stop that. I can't not believe in God. whether that God is a good God or a bad God or an ambivalent God, I can't not believe in him. And that was a process, just saying, well, do I still believe, you know? And yes, at the end of it, I'm like, yes, yeah, well, I do. So do I really believe, if I stop and think about it, do I really believe that God is evil? Do I believe he's ambivalent? Do I believe he doesn't care? Or do I think that God is really a good God? Mm. And at the end of that process, get to the point, well, I don't really understand it all, but I do believe that God is good. I can't believe that God is, we've got some sort of evil dictator looking over us and having a laugh with us. I have, you know, and these are choices, but I have to believe that, you know. And then, well, okay, if I believe that there's a God, if I believe that God is good, do I believe that that goodness, that love is bigger than all of the crap, all of the mess that we see in our lives, in the world? Do I believe that it's bigger than, yeah, do I believe it's bigger than the mess and stuff that's in the church? Yeah, mm. I do, you know. And I think for me, over the last sort of 3 or 4 years, that's really been the journey that I've been on, just in terms of recognizing actually that's where I need to put my faith. And we so easily put our faith in the church, or we so easily put our faith in other Christians. It's interesting. One of the things that I we were talking about a couple of weeks ago was that, you know, the song Jesus Be My Center?
No.
Or Jesus Be the Center or something like that. And Christians quite often talk about Jesus, God is at the center of everything we do. And when you've been in something, you know, when you've been involved in a church or an organization that is, you know, is so driven, has got, you know, and it looks so dynamic, it's very easy when those things are taken away to think, well, where is everything? And you realize that actually, no, God wasn't at the center. What was at the center was your program or your church or whatever, the music that you were doing, you know, and without it, suddenly everything falls apart. Mm. And that's the wrong focus. And it's, I think for people that, if you, you know, for people like me, I suppose, who've been damaged by the church or by people who were Christians, often it's that thing becomes the center rather than God being the center. I think, or we just don't, yeah. I think it realizing that it's, you know, that's those things aren't God, or those things aren't Jesus. Jesus, God is solid and there. And when we let these things that we thought really mattered fall away, then it's still God. And that can be difficult to do, I think.
I was going to say, so yeah, how it is difficult to do. So how do you, very briefly, before we sort of go on to something else, because I said we go off in different tangents here, how do you do it?
Yeah, how do you do it? I mean, yeah, I could make a lot of money if I could write a book on how do you do that, or do an album on how do you do that.
Or a musical.
Yeah. But no, I do think it's just a journey to be on. And I think to say there isn't a God because XYZ happened, I think the important thing is not to shut the door.
Yeah.
And to learn, I suppose, you know, that actually, yeah, God is bigger than all this mess, and that it is the thing that messes us up the most is when we just put our faith and our trust perhaps in the wrong things.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just so easy to do.
Yeah. thank you so much for your honesty so far. It's been brilliant. Yeah. And
I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I don't know. And like I said right at the beginning, when you asked about, you know, who's your favorite hero in the Bible?
Yeah.
You know, it is the guy that says, look, you know, Jesus, help me in my unbelief, because sure, you know, God, I am really having a problem in believing in you right now. And I need your, you know, if you're there, I need a bit of help in believing in you. This, you know, life, the church, people that I should have trusted, I feel like you've really screwed me up and I need you to sort it out.
Yeah. Well, you've been very honest. Thank you so much for sharing that as well. Let's bring you up to date then. With all the experience that you've had, you're still singing, you're still songwriting. You mentioned that you're now the lead singer with After the Fire, but obviously Rob Halligan's still doing the tour as well. You're doing loads of venues coming up over the next few months. What's your raison d'etre for doing it? That's French for I think.
I've got a song on my last album called Promised Land, which was, I've been through this thing recently where I thought, you know, I've been doing this for 20 years. When you start out doing this, you think, I'm going to be famous. I'm going to, you know, I've got my album. I've recorded my album with some brilliant musicians, session guys and stuff. This is going to be it. And you go through all this stuff and, you know, record a video in New York with an Emmy winning producer. You think this is it. And then you do, I don't know, Songs of Praise, get to do a live session on Radio 2, all of these amazing things. And when it doesn't happen, you think, well, absolutely, why am I doing this? And I do it, I think I have to look back and think, you know, my songs have been sung for people walking down the aisle. My songs have been sung at people's funerals. Mm. Some of my lyrics are on somebody's gravestone. Somebody has one of my songs tattooed on their arm, which I just think is a little bit weird, but hey.
No offense to your songwriting, mate.
But I think actually, you know, and there's various charities that I kind of work with. There's a charity called Global Care. We set some stuff up with them to, you know, help vulnerable kids. And it's been amazing. And I think, you know, the reason that I do this now, it isn't about making it, whatever making it is.
Yeah.
It is about just trying to make a difference and realizing that, you know, what we do does make a difference. And so you want that difference to be a positive difference.
Yes.
You know, I can't imagine doing anything different. And sometimes I have to, you know, I really do struggle sometimes and say, God, you know, is this really what you want me to do? Because sometimes when the diary is a bit sparse and there isn't any work and all of that kind of stuff, you think, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing this after all. And then things happen and I don't know, you know. So, we've been looked after over lockdown, which was amazing.
Yes.
You know, the bills that went out, our bank balance didn't change in lockdown, but there was the support and that there, just what went out came in.
Yeah.
Whether it was through online stuff or just people supporting us.
Yes.
And so the reason I do it is because I know that it does make a difference in people's lives, even if it's just one person a gig. Yes. I know that it makes a difference and that's important.
Well, that's fantastic. And if you are that person listening who's got a tattoo on their hand, well, that will say actually a heck of a lot about obviously how your lyrics has meant so much to that person. So, you know,
that is
a phenomenal testimony for both people, really, that you've really inspired someone and obviously means a heck of a lot, which is fantastic. Rob, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. We've just got a 2-minute hero to do in closing. But before we do, let's do a bit of housework. If you want to get hold of us, then you can. That's ogc@accessradio.biz, B-I-Z. This has been a BCSC production. And Rob, please plug away for anything you want to plug away with.
Okay, well, if you are in Kettering, I have a gig in Kettering at the Arts Centre November the 16th. So that's exciting.
Especially what else? This is going out November the 17th. No, I'm joking. It's not.
Also doing got a gig over in Alton Broad at the end of October, and then we're doing a Christmas tour, which is taking us up to starting in Coventry, but taking us up to Scotland. There are still dates available, so if you are up in Scotland and would like a house concert or a stadium concert or anything in between, or you just like me to come and chat in your church, then I'm really happy to do that. So just give us a call, or you can get hold of me at info@robhalligan.co.uk.
info@robhalligan.co.uk, and Halligan spelled H-A-L-L-I-G-A-N.
Yep.
How many stadium gigs have you done, as a matter of interest?
Sorry?
How many stadium gigs have you done, as a matter of interest?
I haven't made a stadium yet. Actually, no, I haven't. I haven't. One of the things, this is a funny little aside, my dad struggled to sort of, you know, boast about me to his friends. But he knew that in the 90s, we used to do these conferences at Wembley Conference Centre. Mm-hmm. And when my dad heard, he would introduce me as his son, and my son's played at Wembley.
Excellent.
So there you go.
Wembley Conference Centre is quite big anyway, isn't it? So
I've been knocked down now, I think.
Has it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's brilliant. Well, Rob, it's been a pleasure talking to you and listening to you, more importantly, what you've been sharing. I did say we'd go off and see where I ended up, and we have, and we've now finished. It just remains for me to say, you have a 2-minute hero slot now, please. Someone to discuss who is preferably dead, has to be dead, so that we know that, you know, like you alluded to earlier on, from people in the past who might have, as history has proven, not be nice people. And just tell us why this person is your hero. So,
Oh, did you warn me about this?
I did.
You probably did, and I've missed it. Okay, hang on a second. My hero. I think my hero is my wife.
Who's not dead.
Oh, no. Do you want somebody that's dead?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
But I'll tell you what. I'm going to make an exception here. I'm going to make an exception because, you know, they often say that behind every great Christian is an amazed wife. So I'm going to make an exception because...
Now I can talk about her. So she's gone out.
She's gone out now, is she? Yes, for those that are hearing noises in the background, your wife was blessing, was helping you out with all the domestic chores, isn't she? I'm gonna let this roll. Go on then. Your wife, why?
My wife, she has stuck through me, stuck with me through so much. It isn't easy being married to someone like me who is, a musician, creative, whatever, making things up all over the place. Somebody that struggles with faith as well. And been on quite, you know, she's been a rock. She really has. She encouraged me. She prays, you know, she's an incredible prayer warrior. It just in terms of, you know, not afraid to sort of just, right, we're going to pray about that. It's the last thing I feel like doing. She's been a brilliant mother. She's a brilliant daughter to her mum, looks after her mum. And she's been a brilliant daughter-in-law to my mum as well, caring for my mum. So that is my wife. She's amazing, and she doesn't think much of herself either. So, and I wouldn't be here without her.
No, I hear that. And hopefully she will listen to this when it goes out, before November the 16th. And before the end of October, so that, you know, we can get the plugs in for your gigs between now and Christmas, and that she will hear that and take that on board, because it's a joke, but it's true. There's always an amazed wife behind every great Christian person, or amazed husband behind every great Christian lady. So please, Jean, take that on board. You both have been through so much, and you know, with Jesus Army and everything else, and you're still here and you're still flying the flag. And hopefully many, many people listening today have been greatly encouraged by what you've said. Rob and Jean, who's out the building, thank you very much, Dee, for joining us today. It's been fantastic.
Thanks, man.
Cheers. Thank you.